This podcast may have explicit content and also has this implicit request. If you follow me on Twitter, why not follow The Gist at Slate Gist? It's Wednesday, July 31st, 2019 from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. There was a debate yesterday. There will be a debate tonight. The debate yesterday was, is Jeffrey Epstein a horrible creep? The debate today is Jeffrey Epstein a deluded, megalomaniacal, horrible creep? Here is the headline from the New York Times. Jeffrey Epstein hoped to seed human race with his DNA. On behalf of the human race, might I say, no thanks. And seed, the verb, hoped to seed, indeed, and may I also say, bleh. The plan was, the far-fetched idea was, again, to quote the Times, Mr. Epstein, over the years, confided in scientists and others about his scheme, according to four people familiar with his thinking, although there is no evidence that it ever came to fruition. No, the human race was, in fact, not seeded by Jeffrey Epstein. I believe that to be true, although I was in New Mexico a few years ago. There were a lot of kids walking around with curly hair and a vaguely Semitic vibe. So maybe we can't say quite so confidently that there's absolutely no evidence that the plan didn't come to fruition. The Times, writing of Epstein's smarmy habit of cozying up to the powerful, they write, he used the same tactics to insinuate himself into an elite scientific community, thus allowing him to pursue his interests in eugenics and other fringe fields like cryonics. So an elite scientific community, but not so elite as to find eugenics and cryonics discredited. Times goes on. Another scientist cultivated by Mr. Epstein, Jason Lanier, a prolific author who is founder of Virtual Reality, said that Mr. Epstein's ideas did not amount to science in that they did not lend themselves to rigorous proof. Oh, so it was the standard of the double-blind study that cast doubt on the idea of I shall found a sex cult with me as Adam. Usually, what casts doubt is the crazy eyes and polyphonic spree wardrobe. That's the tell. It's good to know that in this case, JAMA and the journal Nature wouldn't sign off. Elsewhere in the article, the reaction of three Epstein associates, reactions to his to-do list, if you will. The reactions were described this way, quote, the idea struck all three as far-fetched and disturbing. Yes, yes. Think that's far-fetched and disturbing what you've heard so far, however? Listen to this. One adherent of transhumanism said that he, and by the way, before you go transhuman, just act like a human, which Epstein doesn't seem to have done. Anyway, one adherent said that he and Mr. Epstein discussed the financier's interest in cryonics, an unproven science in which people's bodies are frozen to be brought back to life in the future. Mr. Epstein told this person that he wanted his head and penis to be frozen. Raises a host of questions. How close would the head and penis be situated to each other upon storage? What state would the penis be frozen in? The state of the head being, of course, deranged. Did he leave instructions? Okay. When you show visitors, as soon as someone says, oh my God, what kind of maniac freezes his own penis? That's when you pull out the head. This guy. Another weird detail from the Times piece. He told one scientist that he was bankrolling efforts to identify a mysterious particle that might trigger the feeling that someone is watching you. Apparently, that particle not present in select members of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami. So I do have to say that with all these tales of a human stud farm and a trafficking ring that's more than disturbing, it's evil, all his tales of how he accessed power, how he planned to, you know, freeze his pedophile penis, the possible Ponzi scheme. As a New Yorker, the detail that I just cannot get my head around as regards Jeffrey Epstein is this. The sidewalk outside of his house automatically melted the snow. My God. Well, I guess that's one place that you shouldn't store Jeffrey Epstein's head and penis. On the show today, and listen, I'm sorry for what I just did there. It had to be said, but I am sorry. You didn't ask for it. I just had to process it. Thank you for joining along with me. Anyway, on the show today, I break down, yes, indeed, I just did, I break down the last debate. But first, Chuck Klosterman is here with a new book of short stories and a new collection of kind of long answers stemming from my also fairly long questions. It is a Pesca Klosterman Q&A. Up next, Raised in Captivity author Chuck Klosterman. We right now have a live show to announce. It's in a few weeks, although September doesn't seem like a few weeks. You gotta, you know, get through August. School starts. It's Monday, September 16th at 7 p.m. in the Bell House in Brooklyn. I know you're saying, what, Mike? There's a live podcast show at the Bell House in Brooklyn, as yours has been a few times. Yes, but this is special because it is. Slate presents The Gist Comedy Special Live. Stand-up comics, names you've heard, if you know stand-up comedy, or even if you don't, stand-up comics doing their comedy, getting together, talking to me in a comedic fashion, or at least about comedy. Tickets on sale now if you are in Brooklyn, or plan to be, or just like to laugh. Anyone out there like to laugh? For anyone who's ever had a dream, it's Slate Presents The Gist Comedy Special Live at the Bell House, Monday, September 16th. Go to slate.com/live for tickets and info.
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
Chuck Klosterman is here, as he has before, but in the past, he's always been doing it to talk about one of his many nonfiction works, or just ideas. He likes talking about ideas. So I would say Chuck Klosterman is here as never before, because he is here talking about his new book, Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. It's a collection of short stories, pretty short, pretty punchy. Hello, Chuck.
Hi.
So I will tell you how I experienced this book. I didn't know it wasn't a novel. And for the first three chapters, I was not only saying, I wonder how these people connect, but I was trying to get the rules of reality in the universe. So it starts off, there's a puma on an airplane. I'm like, okay, what he's done here is he's introduced me that this is going to be some sort of, you know, mystical, kind of fictional, magical nonfiction world. And then I'm reading a story about a high school football coach who kind of creates a tornado vortex that gets 2.8 yards to carry. I'm like, okay, now he's marrying it with both the real and the unreal. And then I said, wait a minute, is this short stories?
Yeah, you know, it actually reminds me of the experience I had the first time I watched the movie Slacker. And I kept thinking, it's like, how are these going to intertwine? Like, when did the characters come back? If you'd have read the whole book like that, I think you would have had a real awesome experience that may totally exceed the actual book.
And I think that there are certain points where I would have convinced myself, okay, I see what's going on here. There is a constant theme. Like, one theme is people overhearing other people in bars or in other settings. That happens like three times in your stories. And I wonder, do you do that a lot?
Yes.
So do you interject as some of your characters do?
No.
No? But you wonder what would happen if I did interject. What would be the right ways to interject?
I know that if I did, it would ruin everything. I mean, before we got on here, we were talking about ethics and morality a little bit in kind of goofy terms. We were talking about football. But this is something I have wondered about. Like, I used to love going to, say, like the Brooklyn Tavern when I lived here and sit at the bar and just listen to people having conversations. Is that a wrong thing to do? They're having a conversation in public at a volume where I can hear them without an extra device. Their assumption, though, is that it's a two-person conversation. I sometimes did wonder, am I wrong to do this? But that's my nature. I went into journalism, you know, and I've thought my whole life about being a journalist. And at the same time, it's like, what is the core quality of journalists? We're gossipy people.
I heard or read a couple interviews that you gave about this, and it started out as this crazy thousand-word challenge to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what made that happen or why. I keep mentioning it because it is true. The initial idea for this book was that I was going to write 100 stories that were exactly 1,000 words long.
It is true that creativity flourishes within boundaries, right? And it also is true that there have been some really great works of art that were almost an artificial either idea or a rule for yourself, right? Exile in Guyville. Oh, I'll do a song-by-song answer to Exile on Main Street, even if it's if you didn't tell me that, I couldn't tell how it was an answer to that track. So there's something there. There's to give yourself a little rule. Without that as a jumping-off point, would you have gotten as far as you did?
Well, it probably did help because, you know, the stories in this book are mostly between like 1,200 and maybe 2,200 words. So they're not that much longer than 1,000. And I guess it was kind of fun initially to be trying to fit something so perfectly. You know, like, I don't know. I think a certain kind of person like becomes an accountant. And people who aren't in accounting might be like, what a boring life. And you'll talk to an accountant and they'll be like, oh, there's just something wonderful about having all the columns line up. And like you did all the work perfectly. It was a little like that, you know, almost the feeling of bowling. You know, bowling is a great sport because it is one of the only sports where the average person can often be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not for a whole game, but for a frame. And I was getting it frame by
exactly
frame.
As perfect as the greatest bowler in the world.
Yes.
And that, in fact, if you're a decent bowler, it happens 30 or 40% of the time. That you are as good in that sport as Mike Trout is in his sport in that one swing of the bat, which is crazy. It can't happen in other
sports. You could say the same in golf or whatever, but most good golfers go through their entire life never getting a hole in one or whatever.
Right.
No one has bowled their whole life and they've been like, you know, I've never had a strike. A lot of spares in there. Never a strike, you know what I'm saying?
You give it up after a while. And there's a lot of candle pin and duck pin bowlers who've never even had. I've read a lot of your nonfiction and I think I see some of the ideas or antecedents for what became Columns. And there is the story about the crazy high school football coach who wound up getting 2.8 yards a carry. Does that come from Mike Leach, writing about Mike Leach and his obsessions?
Somebody else brought that up and the honest answer is no, although I definitely see that relationship.
Because Mike Leach is a genius, maybe problematic coach, offensive genius, but also he gets an obsession every offseason. So one offseason, it's Pirates. And this guy, your coach in the story, has an obsession with clocks.
Well, not just but Mike Leach was a lawyer who did not play college football.
Right. His whole thing is I'm not a coach.
And the coach in this is – so, you know – actually, now you've kind of convinced me maybe it was, but it wasn't on the front of my mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how it is with all of these things. I mean, writing fiction in general, like there's something that's in the front of your mind and then you kind of think you're building in subtext, but it is an interpretive, subjective thing. Like if I wrote an essay about, about Mike Leach and someone walked away from it and said like, I really liked this essay. It really kind of illustrated to me a lot about, upholstery. I'd be like, well, that didn't work, you know. But if somebody reads that story about this football coach and they think it has something to do completely unrelated to what I thought, it's still okay. You know, in nonfiction, the most important thing is that the information is true. Okay,
yes.
That's factually accurate. Nobody can say, like, you were wrong about this information because then everything just falls apart. But there are some times probably where there's some cognitive dissonance in it. Like, the person can have two contradictory thoughts at the conclusion. In fiction, that is almost built into it. Like, if the story has no cognitive dissonance, it may not have worked. Whether someone likes these stories is so subjective – I almost didn't worry about it. Whereas with nonfiction, sometimes I do have anxiety over the fact that I don't mind if someone doesn't like it, but I don't want them to say, I don't like it because his rationale is wrong. Like he is not considering these things that he just doesn't know about. Like his sense of history is not good enough to make this. I worry about those things constantly. Now, as a consequence, I probably do make up for a lot of those shortcomings because of the anxiety, I hope.
Uh-huh.
But with this thing, it wasn't like that at all. There was just none of that.
You're driven by ideas, right?
Okay.
I mean, it seems you're enraptured by ideas. You love teasing out an idea.
Well, yes. I mean, although that can't be a rare quality. That's got to be a pretty fucking common thing, right?
I think some people like feelings more than ideas.
Well, you're right. That's actually true. If those are the two things, yes. There are more, and there are more people who like feelings than ideas if those are the only two options. So, yes, okay, I agree with you. My wife will tell me that I have contempt for emotion. She'll say that to me sometimes. And it's an interesting thing because I've almost sort of adopted it. There was a book that came out called Against Empathy.
Yes.
And I was like, I'm going to buy this book. And she's like, that book doesn't mean what you think it means. I know, I've read a review of that book. It does not mean what you think it means.
How would you assess, technically, you've gotten to be a much better writer. That is a self-assessment. But what has fallen away?
I think what has fallen away is my singularity of thought. That when those first two books, when I was in Akron, it was just me. But, you know, you see this in music. You know, it's like I'm sure Paul Westerberg thinks he's a much better musician now than he ever was in The Replacements.
Yeah.
Like, he'll be like, every song we did then, I could do better now and all that stuff. But people who love The Replacements don't feel that way. I think what people really want is raw realness. That there is just that this can only come from this person and there's absolutely nothing being hidden. And I will admit, I've had the luckiest possible life. There were limits to my education. You know, I went to a really small rural public school. I went to a state university. I kind of had to learn things on my own. And if you read all my books in order, one time somebody tried to criticize me by saying this, but to me it was, I wouldn't say a huge compliment, but I think an accurate assessment. They're like, oh, he's like trying to grow a brain in public. Like he just like, you know, like that he's like learning these things, you know. And you know what? There was some truth in that. But I think that there was a huge advantage career-wise and sort of happiness-wise to me having not went to, say, Harvard or Yale or any of these schools where you get this great education,
yeah.
And virtually everyone who graduates from them is very smart, and yet they're all smart in the exact same way. Their taste is almost identical. I was just like, this is me, you know? And now it's harder for me to just be me, but it was a little easier with this because these characters aren't really me.
Yes. I do get the idea of when you go to a place where there's a lot of knowledge and then you as the newcomer say, oh, what about this idea? And the answer is, yeah, it's called postmodern theory. We've been doing it for 100 years. It does.
Well, but and it's,
or whatever it's the theory
is. It's also sometimes it's like kind of taste related. Like, okay, I remember a very early meeting I had at Spin Magazine. So I'm at Spin and we're sitting around and we're talking about different things. We're making some list, I think. And the list is probably something like rock music that involves non-traditional instruments. And I said that I liked the record Cure for Pain by Morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And like one guy at the table actually went like, huh. Yeah, you really are an outsider or whatever. Like they were all so bizarre that I would think the band Morphine was cool. And I was sort of like, God damn it. I had no idea that there was like, that there were this all of these things which I didn't think were popular enough to signify anything. Like it didn't seem like Morphine was that big of a band. There was a lot of things that I had never considered having a meaning that involved hipness or class. But now I know all those things.
Yeah, right.
I now know all, I know the secondary meaning of all of these things, of film and television and music and all this stuff. And then once you know it, you can't unlearn it.
So while I have you here, I want to ask you a couple off-the-wall questions. One is, have you seen that movie, the new movie Yesterday?
You're the second guy who asked me about that today. I have not seen it yet. I have read reviews of it, though.
Yeah, the premise is fascinating, but I wonder if off the top of your head, the one thing they don't deal with is if the Beatles didn't exist, they don't really deal with what would be the ripple effects.
That's,
what would be
yes.
They a little bit. There is one joke about Oasis.
That's
not
the
existing.
Only joke, apparently. Because I've read reviews.
Yes,
I've heard. Okay,
yes. So there's still. Let's pause it. There's still a British invasion, and of course, a lot of that's going to happen.
Okay. Well, now the Stones are the biggest band.
Right.
But okay. But the Stones,
but the Animals might be.
Well, okay.
What
but
the
also,
Stones are.
The Stones. the Beatles introduced to the Stones the idea of, like, you got to write your own material.
Right.
The reason Can't Explain is written by The Who is because Pete Townsend is told by his manager, it's like, the Beatles are here now, they write their own material. So if the Beatles don't exist, it is possible that rock music does not perceive itself as an idiom that needs to have a creative force within it. Now, a lot of poptimist people would have said, that would have been great, we would have loved that, you know?
Right.
But for the most part, I think it would have changed music in a way where it's like a film like Yesterday, if you actually follow through on this premise, the world is different. The Beatles did change the world, and specifically the Beatles. Like, if you remove the Kinks from the history, you know, it's like it's a huge loss because they made great music. But music is more similar today than different. I don't think you can say that about the Beatles.
All right, here's the last thing. I was talking to this professor at Columbia, actually someone who was taking his class, and he says, and this is just based on analysis, there will never be a huge rock band again. There will never be a band on the level of Pearl Jam or U2, not based on anything like taste or an aesthetic assessment. It's just based on how the industry has gone. What do you think?
Absolutely true. That's absolutely right. I mean, there's just, you know, and it's what you say, all these things, it's not about taste or talent. There'll still be talented rock bands writing good material in the same way that there's still jazz artists who put out meaningful jazz, but
right.
it's no longer at the center of the culture. And that's part of it. I mean, you know, I would really argue that though we did not know it at the time and didn't think it at all because it was at a period where the industry was so lucrative, the end of rock music really happened during the grunge period because the bands had become self-aware of the idea that there is something unseemly and uncomfortable about being a rock star. And the part of the attraction of Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder and you know, the guys in Soundgarden, the guys in Alice in Chains and all this, was that their discomfort with the, like, we're going to wear jeans and flannel. We're not going to wear any makeup. We're going to
We're going to lecture the crowd when they understand
it
wrong.
We're going to write, you know, like Eddie Vedder writing Choice on his arms. We're not going to have all that stuff. That was all, I mean, weirdly built into the culture of rock music. And CD sales were still going, you know, these bands were still huge. It still seemed like it was the biggest music, but I feel as though that was really when that ended. And what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, the meaning of rock music, what it really means is that, like, even if you don't care, you're part of it. And that is a better description of hip-hop now.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, there's a lot of people, like, who were really championing hip-hop in the 90s, and they said this was going to happen. They were like, this is what the kids care about and all this. But now I see that they're operating from the position that it's just going to go on forever. That's going to end, too. I mean, nothing should last forever. Nothing does. I mean, marching music did not last forever. Like, you know, it's like these things don't go on in perpetuity.
Nothing lasts forever in the cold November rain. Chuck Klosterman, listen, if you like, I don't know, 10 minutes of interesting ideas, read one of his essays. If you like 20 minutes, read two. The collection is called Raised in Captivity. It's being described on the cover as fictional nonfiction. Don't really know what that means. Doesn't matter.
Well, you know what's funny? If you reverse them, it's the same.
Nonfictional fiction?
That's still fiction. Mm. Fictional nonfiction is still fiction.
He's playing with our heads.
I could have just said stories.
Stories. Chuck Klosterman, a life. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, man.
And now the spiel. What if the rules of the CNN debate last night were applied to some great moments in political history? They might go something like this.
I have nothing to offer but blood.
Thank you.
Toil.
Thank you, Prime Minister.
Tears and sweat.
Thank you. Not just politics. How about music?
And I
thank you.
Will
thank you. Thank you. It actually does work in some songs.
Stop.
Thank you.
Have a time.
Oh, you snuck that one in there, huh? Like a few of the candidates broke a rule and managed to communicate a verboten point despite the tap, tap, tap of the shoulder from Jake Tapper requesting that the candidate leave the dance floor. It seems that CNN wanted to host a debate with the grand plan of not letting any of the debaters debate. I mean, there was Bernie Sanders who got a quick one in when he said,
I do know when I wrote the damn bill.
I wrote the damn bill is both Bernie's battle cry and probable epitaph. Because Bernie has written a lot of bills, many more amendments, but passed very few. In the Senate under Mitch McConnell, it's not fair to judge him for lacking accomplishments. But in the House, this was indeed his reputation, and was a reputation borne out by fact. Big ideas, fewer laws. Of course, if you elect him president, he will get to enact those ideas into law. But since it looks like you won't be electing him president, his reputation will stand, as will his t-shirt. The Sanders camp began circulating an "I wrote the damn bill" t-shirt. Tim Ryan's camp, Tim Ryan has a camp, it's more of a bunk bed. But anyway, Tim Ryan's camp is similarly hawking the "You don't have to yell" t-shirt and bumper sticker, based on this scintillating moment.
You don't have to yell.
I just wonder if in a few years, if we go to Nicaragua or Togo or Ghana, we come across a bunch of people wearing shirts that read, "I wrote the damn bill. I was that little girl. You don't have to yell. Wish list economics. Buffalo Bills Super Bowl champion. XXVI. We'll know where they came from. But the main thing I wonder about is this. The main person, it's Marianne Williamson. I don't know if she's a person, she's a character. She floats above the debate. She penetrates and surrounds the debate. She is in but not of the debate. It is possible that in the third act of the Democratic primary, all will be revealed that this was all an M. Night Shyamalan movie. And Marianne Williamson was the ghost. And Marianne Williamson was a ghost the whole time. Or maybe a spectral force from the future. Or all of our collective pre-Columbian pasts. She did have this moment.
If you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days.
Yeah, I know. That says something. But I will now present to you the five buts of Marianne Williamson. You suspected she may have had a third eye, but Marianne Williamson has at least five buts. Follow the buts along with me. Marianne Williamson held our attention and was interestingly different than everyone else during the debate. But every serious person who has looked into her at all knows she believes in some deeply odd things. One, she's anti-vax. She would dispute that, but she is opposed to mandatory vaccinations, which, of course, have saved countless lives. I guess she's not like most of the 2016 Republican field who motioned to an anti-vax stance on religious grounds. She's at least anti-vax adjacent because of quasi-pseudo scientific grounds. She is a devotee of A Course in Miracles, written by a Manhattan doctor who believed she was channeling the new revelations of Jesus Christ. And she believes you can pray the fat away. Okay, that's one but. The but of, but all the people who have looked into it know she believes some odd things. That's one but. The next but, however, is even if you know all this backstory, the debates are about the moment. And Marianne Williamson was quite good in the moment, sans context. So maybe she, quote, won the debate. But the but to that but is that very few people were watching the debate. Sure, it has good ratings for a cable station on a Tuesday, but with 8.7 million viewers, the debate was just not watched by that many voters. But, watching the debate is not as important as the coverage of the debate, all the memes and the shared media and the next day analysis. Williamson was pretty prevalent in that. But, I'm losing track. But there still are, in our media, some forms of gatekeeper. And they don't really take Marianne Williamson too seriously. But her message works best as a critique or perhaps a soothing salve against the gatekeepers of mass media. Without mass media or medicine, pushback in general, Marianne Williamson wouldn't be as effective as she is. Let me now remove myself from the dark forces of my own wonkishness, because I have chronicled more butts than a Cisco video. Donald Trump, it is true, won as an outsider candidate who was laughed off, but had a message that struck a chord with his party. And yeah, Marianne Williamson has all of those qualities too. Now, one counterargument is that Donald Trump was, from his announcement, the leader in the polls, and Marianne Williamson is at 0.3% in the Real Clear Politics polling average. But what's that? Nine butts? But Donald Trump, and I think this is important, this is why Marianne Williamson is not Donald Trump. Donald Trump had more than just persuasive to his people, persuasive patter. He had a signature policy, which was a more vicious immigration policy than anyone in the field. And he rode that policy and the vivid descriptions of that policy to the nomination. What Marianne Williamson has is a description of darkness, a call to love, but it's not a policy. It's a notion. It's not a plan. And the woman with the plan, Elizabeth Warren, did quite well last night. But Warren, and a statistic, is less surprising than Oprah's mystic. So at the risk of repeated a dreaded Republican talking point.
And we should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk.
I have to say that it doesn't take a dark psychic, the Lord Sauron, or Vigo the Carpathian to discern that Marianne Williamson, though unusual, will not be a lasting candidate in the Democratic field. Of course, they also said a similar thing about another guy who was written off as implausible. And I think you all know where that man is now. He's desperately hawking his Don't Yell t-shirts and bumper stickers. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader did not go to Ivy League schools, and therefore, within them, have preserved such unapproved thoughts as, are there more girls in Austin named Brooklyn or more boys in Brooklyn named Austin? On the show What Next Today, Slate's Jordan Weissman drops by to talk about the drop in interest rates. Jordan Weissman, let me just say this. That guy is a treasure. The Gist. You know, a world without the Beatles means that somewhere in England right now, there's a meter maid named Rita, a guy named Desmond with a barrow in the marketplace, and three kids on a grandfather's knee named Vera, Chuck, and Dave, and none of them have any idea that they're living lives of alternative universe plagiarism. Oom-peru-de-peru-do-peru, and thanks for listening.